I thought we might start by suggesting that we have 10 or 15 minutes of questions before we start, so that people who are late arriving will be able to hear the main factors which I want to talk about. If a question is something which I will be dealing with, I'll ask you to excuse me if I don't answer it then. I'll simply mention that it will be a matter that we'll be covering. So, is anybody... Yes, sir. Mr. Williams. Yes.
The U.S. and all the world goes into recession now. Always previously the selling market has dropped in sympathy. Would it be expected to now?
I think that if the world as a whole goes into recession, that the effects must flow over into Australia as an industrial nation. But I do not believe that the energy and some of the other natural resources stocks in Australia will be greatly affected. I think that the demand for energy is going to be so tight, even in a recession, that I think that probably, certainly relative to the price of stocks in most markets, that they will hold up better than usual. Yes, sir. So far as the United States citizens are concerned who invest in Australian portfolios, there is a 10% withholding tax on dividends. There is a 30% withholding tax on interest. Earned income is taxable at Australian rates, which begin at about $4,000 and which reach a peak at, I think, about $55,000, at which rate the level is 60%. There is, of course, a difference depending on what the structure that you're using is. For instance, if you're using a trust, it's possible to divide the income between a number of beneficiaries and all sorts of different moves in that way. But by and large, most people are interested in Australia only in most people from North America only in terms of investment, and in that case the tax is not great. There is no capital gains tax. Yes, sir. Yes. During the course of the morning, I will be asking you to write down your names, address, and what your particular interests are, and we will. I'll be home towards the end of next week, and I'll get the whole lot processed very rapidly, so that in a matter of 2 to 3 weeks, you should have everything back, the post office permitting. Yes, sir. Yes. I perhaps should qualify that by saying, in the sense that you can buy and sell gold bullion readily, yes, but there is not a central marketplace in the sense that the London market exists. There are a number of bullion dealers, and they will all buy and sell any quantity of gold or silver at any time. And store it, yes. There is no tax. There is a tax on Krugerrands. There is a sales tax on Krugerrands, but there is no sales tax on bullion. Pardon? What is the sales tax on 15%?
Do the banks deal in bullion at all?
Yes, and not all of them. Only one or two. I think they still think it's a barbaric metal, most of them.
European banks have representation there?
No. Well, they have representative offices, but they are not permitted under the Banking Act to perform any normal banking functions.
So you have to set up a new
account. Yes, I'm going to suggest to you that that for North Americans, the way to deal in Australia may well be through Singapore for a number of reasons. Well,
Singapore preferable to Switzerland?
In my opinion, yes.
How would one be funded in Singapore?
That's a question I'll be dealing with.
Oh.
So automatically. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we'll get started, and I thank you for your attendance. Yesterday, I was defeated by time from finishing what I intended to say. This morning, I think that most of those of you who are here will want to learn about what the Pacific and the Far East offers in the way of investment opportunity. I have covered that to some extent yesterday. I will be dealing with matters which may seem not entirely related to that specific topic, but they are, in a sense, at least indirectly. And I would like to begin by perhaps saying a couple of things that I didn't have time to say yesterday. One is that we regard the outlook for gold as an important consideration in assessing your timing of entry into the Australian stock market. Now, this may seem a little ludicrous, in as much as most of the stocks there have no direct relationship with gold in Australia. There are three or four gold mining companies, all of which, of course, have performed very well. But the reason why we have a very great interest in gold, apart from the fact that our clients are interested in it anyway, is because the reasons which cause the price of gold to go very high or to fall sharply are usually the same reasons which cause investors from overseas, that is overseas to Australia, to want to invest in Australian energies and related securities. So that when gold is very high, the price of those sorts of securities in Australia tends to be high because people are buying them for the same reasons as they're buying gold. This, of course, happens because so many factors associated with energy have a bearing on the price of gold. That I mention more to show that there is some relationship between the evaluation of gold and the Australian securities market. Probably I say that partly by way of excuse, because I wasn't invited here to talk on gold. But there is something that I want to say about it, because we have done a lot of work on it. I felt for a number of years that people felt that there was no way in which gold could be evaluated other than by saying that old cliche that anything is worth what the buyer will buy it for or what the seller will sell it for. Now, that is true, but by the same token, anything, whether it's a General Motors piece of General Motors stock or whatever, it does have what Arnold Bernhardt of the value line theory and what old Benjamin Graham used to call the line of central value. There is some intrinsic thing which is causing the price of a stock or the price of a commodity to be worth X at any point of time. And if you think hard enough about gold, the one thing which I have felt, and I'm sure that a lot of you will agree with me on this, that that gold's great use is its role, its historic role as a monetary metal. And in all the years in which the gold standard was operative, it worked pretty well. Between 1933, when the United States established a price of $35 for gold, and 1970-71, gold was priced at a level which gave the total volume of it in international monetary hands a value greater than the face value of all the paper money that was then floating around the world, again in international hands. I'm not talking here about paper money within nations. For instance, I'm not concerned with how much paper money there is in Peru or Australia or Singapore or the United States or Germany or wherever. Paper money properly controlled within a nation is another thing. But paper money that is used to settle international debts between nations is what the original gold standard was really all about. They used to settle their debts between each other with gold. Then the practice grew up of settling debts between each other with paper. Now, what the world distrusted and progressively distrusted more was that paper. Until 1970, the face value of that paper in international central banks and in the International Monetary Fund, the value of that paper was less than the value of the volume of gold, valued at $35 an ounce. Therefore, there was no real pressure on anybody to pay more than $35 an ounce for gold, because the paper money was fully backed by gold up until that point of time, the paper money in international circulation. But in March 1970, the total volume of paper money in the world reached $42.5 billion. And in that month, the volume of gold then in central banks, which was 1,210 million ounces, valued at $35 an ounce, equaled the face value of the paper money then floating around the world. And from that day onwards, the pressure was on for gold to become worth more than $35 an ounce, and indeed it did. So much so that after the lid was kept on it for another year, as you know, President Nixon was forced to shut the gold window. Now, since that date, the face value of paper money, which has been printed mainly by the United States for payment of external deficits, has increased so rapidly that whereas it was $42.5 billion in 1970, today it is $552 billion. Now, the volume of gold in central bank hands has meanwhile decreased from about 1,210 million ounces to about 1,127 million ounces. And if you divide that $550 billion by 1,127, you will get an answer of about $490. And that is what my firm believes to be the intrinsic value of gold. And believing that, as we have for some years, and writing about it in our newsletter, as we have for some years, we have adopted the philosophy for our clients that they should only buy gold or gold futures when the price of gold is below its intrinsic value. As a result, our clients were very heavily into gold until August or whatever last year, and they have been out of gold pretty well, except for a slight dip one day last month, ever since. Now, this brought a lot of unhappiness to our clients in January, when they saw gold at 800 and I'd been telling them not to buy it for the previous 3 months, but they're more happy now. But the point I would make is that the day-to-day price of gold is determined by not only this relationship with paper money, but of course is also determined by a number of emotive factors, such as the hostages in Iran and the Afghanistan problem, and all sorts of other things. Just as the price of a stock is not only governed by what is happening within the company or within the industry, it is governed by political considerations of the day and by other matters. so that the price of gold will seldom be exactly in line with its intrinsic value. It will tend to rise above that intrinsic value, as it did in 1974, and as it did last year and early this year. At other times it will be below its line of intrinsic value, but it is just incredible how a chart on which that line of intrinsic value is drawn has or shows how gold is moving around it rather like a coil. And I am absolutely convinced, and I think most of the readers of our publication are, that that is your yardstick for gold, and I will recommend it to you as strongly as I possibly can. Now, I felt that if there was one useful message I could deliver at this conference, it was that, more importantly than the relationship of my part of the world to security and to investment opportunity. But as I said at the outset, I do believe there is a relationship in any event between the price of gold and the price of a lot of the natural resources stocks in Australia. The other thing which I didn't have time to say yesterday is that in selecting which stocks we buy for our clients or in which stocks we recommend for in our publications, we naturally use the normal fundamental and technical analysis which is used in any stock market in the world. I might add, with a lot less emphasis on fundamentals these days, because we used to have a very large research department. Including about 14 security analysts whose job was to look after individual industries and one thing and another. And really and truly, we got better decisions from our single chartist, who was just looking at charts and not worrying about what the fundamentals were saying. The reason for this, I think, is not shoddy fundamental research work, but the fact that circumstances regarding investment in equities has changed so much in recent years, particularly since 1973. To give you an illustration, and I don't want to bore you with this, but we did a very big research job on the Australian company named Coles, which is the equivalent probably of JC Penney or one of those sorts of operations. It's a large company with a turnover of about $1.5 billion sales per year. And they decided in the early 70s to engage to sell most of their real estate, which they had owned previously, and to lease it back. So we did a very deep research exercise into the effect which this was likely to have on profits. And we concluded that over 5 years, allied to certain other things they were doing, that they could probably double earnings per share. And therefore, we did a calculation which suggested that using their historical price earnings ratio of 16, their price in 1977, which was 5 years ahead of that exercise, would be nearly double what it was at that particular time. And therefore, we gave a recommendation to buy. Interestingly, in 1977, I was looking back over this, and I went to the company file, and I found that they were in fact earning twice what they had been in 1972, and our forecast of earnings had been excellent. In other words, the analyst had done his homework perfectly, but the price of the stock was 35% less than it had been 5 years earlier, because price earnings ratios right across the board, as they have in other countries, had dropped by more than half. So that I said to myself then, well, why are we going to waste all this time on doing research work which can be 100% right and produce a 40% loss? And really, over the past 4 or 5 years, we look at fundamentals to the point of seeing whether there's substance to a company and so forth, but we do not look heavily at fundamentals in terms of massive earnings projections and things of that nature. The result is that we have a much tighter ship than we used to have, and I think it is much more effective as a result of it. Certainly the results which our clients have been obtaining have been much better, although of course that in part has been due to the buoyancy of the Australian and Singapore stock markets, Australia particularly. I say all that as a lead-in to the fact that we do use another valuation technique which we call the volatility factor technique. It's an interesting thing that most stocks in any country tend to have a degree of movement in any 52 weeks period which tends to be reasonably constant. If you take the case of General Motors Corporation in the States, historically the price of that stock has moved 20.1% above and below its mean price on average every 52 weeks period. Now obviously it doesn't mean that in every 52 weeks period it moves exactly 20.1% above and below its mean price, but on average that is the experience. Some years it may move 30% above and below, other years perhaps only 12 or 13. But the point I'm making is that if you chart this particular volatility factor, if you record it, we have it running through a computer, in respect of a great number of stocks, you will find that inevitably all stocks at some time, usually at least twice in every 10-year period, move down into the lower quartile of their traditional price range. And when they get right near the bottom of the lower quartile, unless there is something inherently wrong within the company or within the industry at the time, and that of course is something that you must turn to the fundamentals to look for, you will find that you get some magnificent buying opportunities in some very good stocks. It's a case of being patient. The Australian market has been very relatively high at any rate for the past 18 months, and there have been very few of those situations in Australia, and so we have not been able to use that technique very much since about 1977 in our own market. But there have been opportunities in other markets where we have been able to see this happening. Now at the moment General Motors is pretty close to its lower quartile. Of course there are very good reasons for this, having regard to the state of the automotive industry in the United States and elsewhere, and whether one should act on that would probably be a matter of having a much deeper look into the fundamentals regarding the industry than I have done or had time to do. But I mention the concept as one which I recommend to you, which you can apply in any market, and we keep a table in our publication regarding about 30 of the leading stocks in the Australian market. As I say, it's been pretty useless for the past couple of years because there have been so few of them that have been anywhere near their lower quartile. But equally, of course, you can use the upper quartile as a selling point, although that is much less reliable because once a stock gets ahead of steam on it, it tends to keep on going and often goes beyond what would otherwise be a sell point under that technique. What we do is we keep our eye on the sell point and we follow the stock up through it and wait until it turns around before selling it with a trailing stop loss process. Now those are the two points that I was going to add yesterday, which time defeated me in doing. I propose to turn now to a closer look at some of the Far Eastern situations, and I might add that I have almost no expertise at all so far as Japan is concerned, so I would be grateful if you wouldn't embarrass me by asking me about any particular Japanese stocks. My own company operates out of Melbourne, Australia, and from Singapore, and we have a non-operating company in Hong Kong. If you wish to receive details of any of the services which I'll tell you about, I would ask you to please write your name and address, postcode, zip code I should say, and in particular if there is any particular thing which you wish to have us contact you about, please add that to it. And I will see that we'll be home at the end of next week, and I will see that all the requests are processed immediately, and say that within 2.5 weeks or so you should be getting some reply once again if the post office performs its task, which it so seldom seems to do these days. In both Australia and in Singapore and in Malaysia, to a lesser extent in Hong Kong at the moment, because as I said yesterday, I think the prices there have moved beyond all reason. So I am wary of Hong Kong at the moment, although normally I do regard it as a magnificent place in which to invest, having regard to the government attitude and the fact that it is a perfect example of capitalism at work. But at the moment, the two places in which I suggest you should consider investment are Australia and Singapore. Now, I think Singapore and Australia too, but Singapore is not properly understood. Singapore is an island city. It is only 26 miles long by 14 miles wide, and it is diamond-shaped, so that its total area of land is only about 280 square miles. It has a population of about 2.5 million people, but it is a magnificent place. It is, in my opinion, relatively, at any rate, secure. The only threat to Singapore is Vietnam, and before Vietnam could create any real problem in Singapore, they would first have to go into Thailand and then go into Malaysia, or perhaps go into both simultaneously. They would have to conquer those countries, which would perhaps not be too difficult for a Soviet-backed army. But even then, they would be left with the task of going across the water, short distance, true, and doing something about Singapore. And I really don't believe they would try, because I think it would suit them to have another Hong Kong at the end of the Malaysian Peninsula. Hong Kong is a marvellous asset to Red China, and I think that the other people would find Singapore to be a good trading asset to have at the end of their road, if ever they should get that far. Frankly, I don't believe Vietnam will even try to go into Thailand or Malaysia, but that is only a matter of personal opinion. But when they do get to Singapore, they've got the Singapore Army and Air Force to worry about. That is an army and an air force which is Israeli trained, which is manned by considerable numbers. The population of Singapore, the male population of Singapore, is obliged to engage in national service training for a number of years and to remain on the reserve until age 40, and for most of those years to do continuous military training. Singapore would not be an easy place to overrun, if indeed anybody wanted to overrun it. The banking structure in Singapore is magnificent. The speaker last night made the observation that you haven't seen anything until you've seen an IRS investigator try to get some information out of a Chinese banker. And I thought that was a very, very good expression, because the Chinese banker will tell you nothing. We are fortunate enough, my company is fortunate enough, to have been 10 years in Singapore. We're fairly well known in the area. Our offices are on the 40th floor of the Overseas Chinese Banking Corporation building. We have come to know the bank very well. That is a Chinese bank. It is not the biggest bank in the area, because the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, which is owned partly in Hong Kong, partly in the United Kingdom, is the largest bank in the Far East. And of course they have a very big operation in Singapore, and we bank with them, as well as banking with the Overseas Chinese Bank. But I am sufficiently cynical these days to be wary of computers. And the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, having its ties with the United Kingdom, which doesn't concern me too much, but it also has a subsidiary in the United States, which might concern you a little. And if I was an American citizen and was wanting to choose a bank in Singapore, I would choose the OCBC. It is a very large bank, and if you wish to think about that and to do anything about it, if you would care to mention that on the sheet of paper which you hand in, I will arrange for you to be put in touch with one of the senior officers of the bank so that you can at least get top line treatment from the first day. The full name of the bank is Oversea, without the S on the end, Oversea Chinese Banking Corporation. It is the biggest local bank in Singapore. Its stock is the IBM of Singapore, if you like. It is the stock most wanted by institutions in Singapore. The result is it still commands a price-earnings ratio of over 20, even in this day and age.
Question is, since
Firstly, let me say that I did not know that the Monetary Authority permitted banks in Singapore to exchange information. Therefore, I have no idea of the extent to which they might do so. Regarding the second point, we do not use ourselves numbered accounts through the bank. We haven't regarded that there's been any, we haven't considered that there has been any reason to do so, but we do refer to numbers for identification purposes in our dealings with the bank's trust company, which is called the Bankers Trust, so far as our clients, some of our clients' accounts are concerned. Does that answer your question? I have had no reason to try to open that type of account in Singapore, so I cannot really give you... No, I do not know. I imagined that there would be no problem, but I must confess that I have not endeavoured to open that type of account. It would be perhaps appropriate, before I go any further, to ask if there are any questions about what has already been said, because I've covered three topics briefly. I've covered the valuation of gold and the manner in which we see it. I've covered the method of valuing shares using the volatility factor, and I've touched on the banking in Singapore. Is there anything at this stage that... Yes, the lady at the back? I'm sorry, could you speak? Yes, I will do that just a little later. Yes, Mr. Haley.
You mentioned yesterday the strength of the Singapore dollar. Could you speak about that a little more? Where is trading available? And what kind of interest rates on deposits are available in Singapore?
I'm not sure. I've been away for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and things change so rapidly these days that I don't want to quote things too carefully. The rates in Singapore have been far, far less than they have been in this part of the world in recent times, as you will appreciate. In fact, 6 months ago, they were talking about short-term rates of about 4 to 6%, but of course it has been higher than that since the general rate structure has gone up, and has been more of the order of 8 to 10% earlier this year. What was the other question? I'm sorry.
Well, where is the Singapore dollar traded? Is it trading outside Singapore?
I have not seen it traded widely. It's a good currency in which to hold your money, but in terms of currency trading, such as trading in Swissies or trading in Deutschmarks or trading in yen, it is certainly not a prominent member of the currencies trading group in that sense. Yes?
Relationship of gold as a 1980, how do you see that fluctuating in the future? In other words, as more money is put into it, more gold is mined.
Well, you're talking in terms of our intrinsic value calculation. Well, we have projected that ahead to 1984 on the basis that the paper money creation process continues over the next 4 years on the same at the same rate as it has in the past 10, and on that basis gold, the intrinsic value of gold would go I know it would go to $1,140 by 1984. I have an earlier figure, just if you'll excuse me a moment. this projection shows these calculations, and remember, this was calculated on the 18th of March of this year, and it assumed that the face value of paper money in international monetary reserves as at that date would continue to increase at the same rate as they had increased since 1970. And this calculation showed that on that basis, gold would have an intrinsic value of $546 at the end of this year, $663 at the end of 1981, $799 at the end of 1982, $958 at the end of 1983, and $1,145 at the end of 1984. Now, that, of course, can be altered substantially by any increase or decrease in the rate of paper money creation process during that period. But it is, in my view, most unlikely to be less than that, and if anything, more likely to be more. I might add, and I didn't say this in my original discussion on this topic, I don't think I explained this properly, that what we define as paper money in international money circles is the total, is four things. It used to be three, but it obviously had to be made four for reasons which I'll touch on in a moment. It is firstly the total of all foreign currency held by all the central banks which are members of the International Monetary Fund. Secondly, it is the total of all the special drawing rights which have been created by the International Monetary Fund, because they are only another form of funny money. Thirdly, it is the total of reserve positions in the International Monetary Fund, which nations can draw upon when need be. Now, I would mention that of those three components, the actual currencies in foreign currencies, foreign exchange in central banks represents about 80% of the total. It became apparent to us last year that there was something wrong with the statistics being issued by the International Monetary Fund, because the surpluses which were being recorded by the countries of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Libya, Iran, Iraq, and the United Arab Emirates did not tally with the reserves which those countries were being stated as holding in the official statistics published by the IMF. And so we undertook a pretty extensive exercise, which we published over two issues of our newsletter, in which we went back to 1973 and we examined the surpluses of those six countries and the known dispositions of those surpluses so far as they could possibly be traced. And there was something of the order of more than $120 billion that was unaccounted for. Now, the International Currency Review, which is published in London and which is a publication which, if you don't subscribe to it, I strongly recommend that you should. The International Currency Review. I will try in a moment to see if I have a note of their address here. I think it is about, it comes out twice every 2 months, six issues a year, and I think the cost is about $100, but I'll try to find that before I leave. But that publication claims, and with a lot of supporting evidence, that these particular nations to which I had referred have invested on short, in one form or another of short-term investment in the United States, over $100 billion. And that confirms, really, the sort of answer that we arrived at in an entirely independent fashion.